Welcome to 90.5 WESA, Life of Learning Community Forum. I'm Larkin Page Jacobs. When a state budget is finally passed, schools will receive about $6 billion from the Commonwealth. On average, that'll make up about 36% of the school district's revenue. According to federal data, Pennsylvania's home to the widest gap in funding between the poorest and wealthiest communities. While all of Pennsylvania's 500 school districts receive state and federal funding, many of them are also heavily dependent on local revenues, including property taxes. That doesn't always mean poorer districts receive less money from the Commonwealth, but it does mean that they're more dependent on the state for much of their funding. Pennsylvania is one of the few states that doesn't have a funding formula that accounts for the poverty rate of a district. During this forum, we'll explore the meaning of equitable funding for public education. This is a complicated topic. You're going to hear a lot of numbers, but it's about more than just dollars when it comes to a child's education. Here to help explain the topic are State Senator Jay Costa, a member of the Basic Education Funding Commission, Ron Cowell, president of the Education Policy and Leadership Center, Linda Kraushor, executive director of the Consortium for Public Education, Linda Lane, superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools, and Eric Montardi, senior policy analyst for the Allegheny Institute for Public Policy. A reminder to the audience, we'll be taking your questions throughout the evening, but first to the panel. I'm going to start by asking how each of you would define equitable funding for public education. Start with you, Jay Costa.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for the chance to be here to talk about this important issue and very timely issue, I think I might add, as we go forward in our budget conversations. I mean, to me, equitable funding means that we take in various factors and considerations to finding the best way possible to make certain that every child gets a good education. And the investments are made along those lines to be able to be certain that that is, in fact, the case. So you look at various factors and variables to come with an appropriate formula to try to achieve that.
The conversation has really moved beyond the word equitable, and it's really about adequacy now. Back in the 70s and even the 80s, there was a lot of discussion among policymakers and the courts and others about equalness. But once we began to have academic standards, expectations of all students, defined by state law in our 50 states, there became a new measure of the appropriateness of a statewide school funding system. And so now the real test is adequate funding for every student, regardless of where the dollars come from. We need to keep in mind, though, that the purpose of a state-level funding system and the purpose of state funding is to level the playing field because, as you suggested in your introduction, we've got 500 districts in this state with very different circumstances, very different means to pay their own way. So the real question is, do we provide adequate funding to give every student a reasonable opportunity to accomplish these academic expectations or these academic proficiencies for which we now hold them accountable? That's the real challenge.
And that was Ron Cowell. Mm-hmm. Linda Kraushor.
And as we talk about equity and adequacy, we also look at the idea of an opportunity to learn for every child. And an opportunity to learn means that if we want all children to achieve, then we need to be thinking about what that takes for each child. And it is not across the board a similar concept. Trying to understand that one child may need a paper and a pencil and a book, and another may need so much more to give them the chance to achieve is something that is very difficult for many people to consider. But if we want an economy that truly is growing the number of prepared workers, ready workers, etc., not only do we have to find hope and confidence for every child to believe that they are part of the future, but we have to create the chance for them to have success in their learning, and we have to think about how that differs across the children of Pennsylvania.
Dr. Lee?
Two things come to mind when I think about this particular topic, especially as we begin talking about it over the course of the last year or so. One, I was very unused to seeing such a wide variation in spend per child across a state. Coming from a state with a foundation aid formula, it was pretty tight. I mean, most of us were spending about the same, and the state really made up the gap for poorer communities. So that, to me, was, as I said, first time I'd seen that was when I came to Pennsylvania, which I found quite unusual. Another piece that I was surprised at is I was used to an algorithm that told me about how much money we were going to get based on allowable growth. And so it wasn't predictable because, I mean, it was a bad corn crop, you didn't get much money. That's how it worked. But it was that everybody could figure out how much everybody else would get. And so we all knew what numbers went into it. And that is something that I was unused to, not having, because this appeared to be to me more of a black box. I didn't know what went on in there. A number came out, but I didn't know how it got there. And the last thing I think we're very concerned about is the difference between equity and equality. Equality, you know, equal is everybody gets treated the same. And I think we all know, and our best example, well, two great examples are children with special needs, children that are English language learners. And we all know, and we all accept the fact, it costs more to educate them well. They just need more support and typically more social services than some of our other children. So thinking about that, because for us, that issue of equity will be extremely important, what that looks like. And I'm always wanting to know who's going to define it, because that's really very important to us.
And Eric?
I would say that after listening and reviewing what the Basic Education Funding Commission did for a year, and they listened to about 100 different testifiers, including some of the folks that were up here this evening, experts from around the country, I guess equitable funding would be that the way Pennsylvania does it, which is a combination of state and local finances, means that the places that need more money from the state get more money from the state. But that doesn't necessarily mean, when you put all the sources together, that the state money means that those districts spend more or have more revenue per pupil than the places that just can raise a lot of money locally. And I think until we get to the crux of that issue, even driving out new money through this formula, we may see results that may not look equitable as compared to what we've been doing for the last few decades.
Okay, so speaking of what we've been doing for the last few decades, I wanted to ask, why is a mandated funding formula important? And I know that, Ron, you know a little bit of the history, and so I was hoping you could speak to that and then maybe open it up.
Well, it's important that you have a rational way of distributing billions of dollars of state money and that that rational way be attached to a purpose. So that there is equity, but equity of opportunity for all kids, regardless of the zip code where you live or the relative wealth of your district. We had a rational formula in Pennsylvania in the 70s and 80s when the assumption was that the legislature or state government was going to fund about 50% of K-12 education. And we actually did that in 1974, shortly after Pennsylvania initiated an income tax. State was pretty flush with money, and our state share got up to about 54% in 1974. Now it's down around 35-36%, depending on what year. So we had that formula, but we began to dishonor it. And this goes back to even my days in the legislature. When the legislature found it inconvenient to provide sufficient dollars to support a formula, if you manipulate a formula and you just change a dollar figure a little bit to serve the needs of the legislature, you save the state money, but you begin to shift more and more of the burden to local government. And the more that you make the system dependent on local wealth, the more you make it likely that there'll be this unevenness of opportunity for kids. Because in some communities, no matter how much you try to tax, there's just not a tax base there. So this formula is important now because it was abandoned about 20 years ago. Just became inconvenient for the legislature to appropriately fund it. And then finally we quit pretending that we were supporting a formula and just began a more arbitrary distribution of dollars based on an arbitrary appropriation. But the formula is important, one, because it ought to be based on the needs of kids. Secondly, it ought to speak to predictability. That is, the superintendents and others in the field will know what they're supposed to get from the state. And thirdly, it ought to create an obligation for state government.
And Jay Costa, would you call the distribution of funds arbitrary right now?
I think they have been, as Representative Kyle talked about. But I think as we go forward, The question today and going forward this week will be determining how we drive out these new dollars that we're discussing in Harrisburg, whether they be for this year, which is the 15-16 year, or 16-17. That answer hasn't been reached yet in terms of how we're going to deal with this year's money. Next year, I think you'll see us driving out resources under a new formula, the new basic education formula. But this year, you may see some type of a hybrid or something along those lines, or some type of a combining of various ideas with respect to how we drive it out this year. So I guess to continue some of the things that have gone on for a number of years.
You mentioned that the budget is like a black box for you. Well, what does that look like in day-to-day operations? What does that mean for you? This is Linda Lane.
And of course, our district is on a different budget cycle than I think everybody else in the state, except for maybe one, because we're on a calendar year cycle, not a fiscal year. And even though that seems strange at first, it actually has helped us with this kind of unpredictability of where we're going to be from year to year on money. We're going to be presenting the 2016 budget to the board. They'll vote on a budget next month. And ordinarily, if you don't know and you start building a budget, because we start in the spring, and we don't have any idea as to where we're going to be in terms of the state revenue. Our other revenue is a little more predictable. Earned income tax is more predictable. Property tax is more predictable. But that piece of it has been, we just have to wait. And so, as I said, you're developing a budget that's based on some assumptions. And, you know, you can be wrong.
Okay. Linda Krauscher, you called it fiction.
Yeah, you weren't supposed to hear that. But I do think sometimes that's exactly what is happening. And it's a shame to have such good intentions and watch them be cast aside because the reality is not what one expects.
Anything you wanted to add, Eric?
If you look at the preliminary results right now, just in Allegheny County, the districts that are at the top getting the most money per pupil from the state from the previous year, 14-15, they're pretty much at the top with the formula. It's going to take a long time for this formula to kick in because there's a three-year rolling average on enrollment. There's issues related to the density or the sparsity of the district. There's relative factors to the state on median household income. So, you know, if you think of the districts here and say, well, which ones do I think get the most money from the state based on the wealth of the community? Or the lack of wealth, and which districts do I think get the least amount of money from the state based on the wealth of the community? It doesn't move much next year based on just taking the formula and saying, let's put $100 million through it. It's going to take a long time because, again, the proposal that's on the table now is, well, you're still going to get what you got in 14-15. We're just going to take new money and put it out through the formula. And again, yeah, it is rational and predictable to put the state money through a formula. What's the formula for the local money? It's based on what the community can raise, I guess. Again, it kind of gets to this point of, well, yeah, there is this gap between districts, but how much of that is on the part of the state as opposed to what's being raised locally?
I wanted to ask you, Jay Costa, when you first met with the commission, what was your plan? Before you even had the recommendations, what was the goal?
My goal was to make certain that we came out of it with a product that was going to be able to provide for an appropriate funding plan and recommendation that would be reasonable and acceptable to the General Assembly, and that was one of our challenges. If I had written the plan, I think it looked a lot different than maybe Chairman Brown would have written. So my goal was to try to get in and work to develop something that could be accepted and adopted in an unanimous way as we did to help move through this process.
Okay. And Ron Cal, I know you also gave testimony during some of the hearings, but what did you have to say?
Yeah, 2 points I wanted to make. This idea of the hold harmless. That is the principle that a school district will get at least what it got the year before and nothing less. On the one hand, that's absurd. All of your kids could disappear, and with that principle applied, you would still get the same amount of money from the state that you got the year before. And in some ways, the accumulation of applying that principle for decades leads to some pretty strange situations in the view of some, because districts have had a dramatic decrease in population, student enrollment, but they're still getting what they got from the state in years past. But on the other hand, no legislator wants to go back home and announce to their constituents, I got you less money than you got last year. So there's a political reality to this hold harmless principle. But the other reality also that is makes a lot more sense beyond the politics is that the state has been so bad at appropriately funding all school districts, but particularly the poorest, that probably all districts could reasonably make the case that they're not getting a fair share from the state to begin with. So the idea of giving them less, even though they lost some kids, it just is more salt in the wound, if you will. So the idea, the purpose, you asked Senator Costa about what he had in mind with the commission. The idea was to create a more reasonable way of distributing the new state money. Now, again, ideally, you might apply that principle to all the money, but there'd be winners and losers again. And the political reality is that's not going to happen. But if you can begin to distribute $300 or $400 million of new money this year and another $200, $300, $400 million next year, as Eric said, it takes a while to cure the issue, make it better, but you begin to make important strides forward.
And you also gave testimony during the hearings.
Yes, Linda twice. Yes.
What were you trying to convey?
And one of the things I spoke about was hold harmless as well, because Pittsburgh Public Schools has been protected because of enrollment laws through hold harmless. The district, as everybody who's local knows, has done a lot to deal with our budget issues and reduce our spending. And you know, we've laid off staff, we've closed schools. So, however, hold harmless has kept it from being even worse. And for us, hold harmless is significant. We're talking millions of dollars here. And for us to have to absorb that at one time would be, it can't work. We just can't do it. So it's very important to us that hold harmless stay in place.
So I'm going to run through the commission's recommendations, and they include accounting for the number of students in a district, percent of students living below the poverty line, the number of English language learners, foster care and homeless student information, charter school enrollment, adjustment for student counts in small rural districts, and household median income and the district's ability to generate tax revenue. And I would ask all of you, that's a lot of stipulations, did the commission get the formula right?
I would say yes.
Jay Costa says yes.
I voted for it twice, yes.
Most of those things have been around in the past, but there's one important element that is really important to many school districts, including here in Allegheny County, certainly the Pittsburgh district, and that's consideration of charter school students. That's a new element to the formula, and it just reflects the reality that we have some school districts in the state, particularly urban districts, but not exclusively urban districts, that are faced with enormous additional costs to support students who, for whom they have an obligation, but who happen to be enrolled in charter schools. And so the school district has to write a check to those charter schools. So this is an important addition to the formula.
One of the things that I think for an urban district like ours and several others in the state that kind of has gotten left out of this discussion is achievement disparities based on race. And that's important to consider as well. We in our district are fighting that battle to make sure that our children of color are achieving similarly as our other children in the district. And that's been a struggle. When I testified, one of the things I asked that the legislators consider was how can we provide better mental health, those type of services for children who live some kind of traumatizing existence sometime. And when I talked to our principals last year, that was a recurring theme I heard from them. We need more mental health services. And that's something that I think often doesn't get considered in a state where most of the districts are probably a little different than ours in many ways. But as I said, for us, this is really important. And that, as far as I know, is not a part of what's going to be considered.
I would say the one thing that we probably are not thinking about in this part of the state that the commission did hear from other parts of the state about the hold harmless is, I mean, we have one district probably in Allegheny County, South Fayette, that's grown by more than 150, what they call ADM, average daily membership, which is basically a proxy for headcount. Well, in this formula, there's this three-year rolling average of your enrollment. I mean, the commission did hear, you know, from a lot of people, superintendents and board members from other parts of Pennsylvania where they have districts that are growing, and they say, you know, we have more students, but yet, you know, communities out west, you know, in the rural parts or in the urban parts are basically just getting the same amount that they got years before.
It's a Life of Learning Community Forum on 90.5 WESA. We're discussing equitable funding for public education in Pennsylvania with our panel, Eric Montardi from the Allegheny Institute, Linda Lane, Superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools, Linda Kraushor of the Consortium for Public Education, State Senator Jay Costa, and an audience at the Community Broadcast Center. And with that, I want to turn it over to the audience for a moment and take any questions you might have. Yes, one in the back.
Hi, my name is Ken Harrisby from Brownsville, Pennsylvania, and I had a question generally about the effect of taxpayer-funded cyber schools. It seems possibly to me that it would be difficult to maintain proper standards and making sure the students are getting the education they would get in a regular environment. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that, please?
I'd love to respond to that.
Sure.
We have a number of charter schools that our board has chartered in the district, about nine, and supporting our charter schools is part of what we do. However, the idea that we are paying the same per student cost to children in a cyber charter as a regular charter, I don't understand. And why is that? Because the actual cost of educating a child in a cyber school, whether it's charter or otherwise, is substantially less than it is in a brick-and-mortar school.
I can tell you that the earlier in March, the governor's proposal included significant changes and reforms to how we fund our charter schools, particularly our cyber schools. In fact, what they did was they went around the state and looked at the IUs and how they've handled the charter school the cyber school programs, and came up with an average. I think it was like $5,900 per student. And looking at how we fund our charter schools and some of the accountability measures and things along those lines, transparency and the like, we've not been able to focus on that as part of this budget. I do expect that this will be another conversation that will begin with the governor's next budget address, which will be in February, to continue to talk about some of the reforms that need to take place along those lines.
And Linda Kraushor, did you want to speak to that at all?
I think that when we think about our charter schools and we think about our K-12 schools that we're used to, we think about a classroom of 25 students, that when five students are taken out of it, one still needs a teacher, one still needs a classroom, one still needs all of the resources that go with that student and that student deserves. But all of a sudden, a lot of money is leaving that classroom because a student is making another choice. And it takes away from opportunities to provide technology. It takes away from opportunities to provide many other things.
I have another question at the back of the room.
I started my teaching career in Illinois. And in Illinois, the how the charter versus district money goes is the state issues the money to the charters. So I'm going to ask specifically to all of you if you could share your thoughts on the idea of money coming straight from the state to charters and not through districts.
Wendelline?
Our concern about such a plan would be one of the things that happens now is when our charters send us who the children are that they're educating, you know, what the child's address and all those kind of things, we audit that bill. And typically we find children that aren't at that school. Sometimes they may have been at one point and they're not now. They may have come back to us. They may have gone someplace else. So if there were a process in place to ensure there was going to be an auditing of who's being reported as a part of that charge for the charter education part of it, then that would be something I'd be concerned about. And I guess because I know Pennsylvania Department of Education is pretty stretched out right now in terms of small staff, and I would be concerned as to whether they would be able to do such a thing, because it's a lot of work for us. So that would be our worry.
Ron, you've been waiting.
Yeah. First, I think it's really important when we have this discussion about charters that we distinguish between cyber charter schools and brick-and-mortar charter schools. Secondly, the legislature, in the late 90s, when passing this charter school law, one didn't anticipate this thing called cyber education, cyber charter schools. The internet was still a baby then. And they also made some really wrong assumptions about the funding issue. It was assumed that school districts would save money because students would go to charter schools. And so they set up a system that was kind of predicated on that assumption. But that's like with this audience that we have here this evening. If one of you got up and walked out, and you might be 5% of the audience, the light bill is not 5% less than it was. Or if somebody was getting paid for this, their salary wasn't going to be reduced by 5%. So the law and the funding mechanism was predicated on some really wrong thinking. And the legislature recognized that for a number of years when they began to reimburse school districts for up to 30% of their charter school payments. But then part of the nearly billion-dollar cut that occurred in 2011 was the elimination of what was then $223 million of state support going to school districts to help them be reimbursed for some of their charter school expenses. The question that was asked, will we change the system dramatically and go to state money going directly to the charter schools, be they cyber or brick and mortar? Not likely to happen, but we need to better fund all of public education, the charters being a part of it. Now, on the issue of the cybers in particular, the reality is that in Pennsylvania, the several cyber charter schools that we have, unanimously have been failing from an academic standpoint. Final comment I would make, though, because a lot of my friends in the advocacy community, including some legislators, sometimes get overexcited about indicting cybers. We got to be careful. We're going to see more and more cyber education conducted by our intermediate units and our school districts. It's just going to be a part of the way we educate kids. So even while we challenge the idea of cyber charter schools in Pennsylvania, we need to be careful that we don't indict cyber education in its totality, because it's part of the new way that we're educating a lot of kids, at least in part.
And Eric, did you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to just mention to the person that raised the question, how many school districts does Illinois have? It's more than Pennsylvania. It's about 150 more, I believe, just like Ohio. And somehow they've managed to figure out that the state can somehow just say, okay, we're going to send the money directly to the student. The student takes it either to the school district or they go to a charter school. I don't know if that's the way the funding formula works, but somehow they've figured that out. So imagine a system like that in Pennsylvania where we've kind of done away with the locals don't have a role in, we're raising this much money for education. It's the state funds it, whether it comes to, you have to come through a tax shift, sales, income tax, whatever. The state funds 100% of the education, and then the state decides what's equitable, what's fair. Is it we give the same amount per pupil in no matter where you live, if it's based on districts, or do you say, well, if you're based in a district that's property tax poor or personal income poor, we give you more on a per pupil basis. But at least we know then the distinctions between how much the state is doing. It's not the gap caused by, well, this local community can raise this much money to send to its schools, and the state kicks this much money in, and while here it's 70%, and then this district it's 50% because of the way the ratios work out.
I think it's important to note that in the view of most of the national observers, there's only one state that has a worse school funding system than Pennsylvania, and that is Illinois. So I'm not sure we want to model ourselves after Illinois.
Okay, we're going to take one more question before we head into further panel discussion. Go ahead.
Good evening. My name is Cheryl Kleiman. I'm with the Education Law Center. And Dr. Lane, you've talked about a few of the factors that you're either currently getting additional funding for or the formulas identified. And I was actually hoping you could talk a little bit more about English language learners, mm-hmm. because not only do they have unique needs, but districts like Pittsburgh are not serving a predominantly, for example, Spanish-speaking population. Instead, the students you're educating are from diverse refugee and immigration communities. And I know many of those students are also students with disabilities, so appreciate the challenges. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little more.
That has been extremely challenging. Unlike most districts our size around the country, our English language learners are not Spanish-speaking. And our largest growing language group last year was Uzbek. And as I told the commission, finding people to translate and work with families and be able to talk to the kids is tough. It's tough. Because our distribution is across smaller numbers of many, many languages. I think we're at like 32 right now. And so that in and of itself makes it harder for our ELL program to serve kids' needs. It'd be different if all the kids spoke Spanish, and they don't. So that makes it harder. The other piece, as you said, is the issue of children who have some kind of special education need but are not English-speaking. Our special education people who make these diagnoses typically don't speak Uzbek. And so being able to get accurate identification of learning needs for kids that don't speak English when they're in very small and limited language groups for us to have translation services and those kinds of things are really important.
As we mentioned before, the state pays for about 36% of the cost of students' education. Pennsylvania's been criticized for being below the 50% mark. Jay Costa, wondering why the panel didn't take up the issues of funding levels and funding sources.
I just think that there were many other challenges that I think they wanted to focus on. I think the goal is to get to a 50% funding formula in Pennsylvania. How soon we get there remains to be seen. The governor and his proposal, if you combine the changes he proposed in property tax relief combined with the levels of funding he wanted to provide, I think would have helped us get there sooner than later. But at the end of the day, I think the goal was not to set a particular funding level of 50%, but work towards that with something that we could, that would be real, that we can make those investments in an appropriate way as we went forward.
Anybody else?
Well, I think, again, from my sideline perch, the majority leadership of the legislature, which to its credit supported the creation of the commission, but it also was of a mind and I think gave some direction to the commission and participated in the commission's work. They didn't want to create a situation where the legislature would be obligated to any particular level of funding, short-term or longer-term.
We always said that if the formula had been funded at 50%, the old formula, we would be in a very different place today. And we couldn't do that. How many years were we at 50%? About three?
Back not in the long. 70s, I guess.
About three, yeah. 3 years maybe or something. And we haven't been since. So it's very interesting now we have a new formula, and I think what we all need to do is hold people accountable to fund it at the level it's meant to be funded at.
According to the State Department of Education, on average, $13,000 is spent per student per year. I'd like to start with Linda Lane. PPS spends about $19,200 per student. What goes into that number?
Our spend per child, actually, I just got newer numbers, and it's actually higher than 19. It's 21, around 21.7, I think. But we are 16th of the 500 districts in spend per child. However, the things that I think have to be understood is when that has been part of a structure of a school district over a course of quite a bit of time, what happens is it's not always easy to adjust that in a way that isn't extremely painful. Mm-hmm. And we've done some of that. There are, I'm sure, some people in this room that live through the right-sizing, which was going on in 2006, that closed 22 schools in the school district, to try to adjust that spend per child, to deal with larger schools actually are usually more efficiently operated than small ones. And so getting our schools a little bit larger can help. And I'm very supportive of districts around the state which are growing, getting more money. That only makes sense to me. But I just don't want my kids to pay the price.
Well, I think it's just important because folks like to throw around that $13,000 figure, and it looks good in terms of our national ranking. We are close to the top 10. $13,000 looks good, sounds good. But it masks the fact that that good-looking figure is largely due to the generosity of taxpayers, local taxpayers around the state, including here in Pittsburgh. It also masks the fact that that $13,000 is what it's called, an average. Our low-spending districts are somewhere less than 10. We have some other districts out in the Philadelphia area that drive up that average because they're spending close to $30,000 per student per year. And the moral dilemma, in the view of many, is that it is in many places the kids who have the greatest needs, who are in areas, in districts, where they might even be close to that $13,000 figure, but it's most inadequate. If you're dealing with a complicated school district with many international languages, with many kids with special needs, many kids who need support services of various types.
Well, I feel like the $13,000 or the $21,000 is very opaque. We don't actually know. It changes from district to district. What exactly does that number mean? Where's the money going?
Well, basically, it's the things you might expect. Just like we talked about keeping the lights on, we have to keep the lights on, right? We have to clean schools. We have to provide security people. We have school police. Of course, in any school district, the biggest spend is people. Because it's only people that can do the teaching and being the principal and fixing lunch and all those kinds of things for children. So most of it is going to go towards salary and benefits for the employees. But then, of course, just like you have at your house, you know, we've got supplies and materials, and kids would like to have books. I have parents that come basically to our public hearing regularly and ask for things like, you know, we'd love to have more art teachers in our schools. We'd love to have more music. We'd love to have kids have librarian in their school. We don't have those things right now. We have each school gets a little bit of each of those things. And so, you know, I'm in the position of sitting there listening to people describe what they really would love to see, which we'd love to be able to do. Because I totally support the idea that it's not just about reading and math. But on the other hand, you know, we have to, at the end of the day, the numbers have to add up.
Linda, I think one of the other things that's really difficult is to quit doing something that hasn't continued to work for you. And I think everybody finds that, the legislature, a school, a family. We really need to begin to look at what is producing according to those dollars that are being assigned. And when we need to make a change, we need to have the courage and do difficult things. And sometimes those discussions are very difficult and become plagued with politics.
Eric, did you want to mention?
Well, I think, I mean, the Pittsburgh number, I mean, that has been brought up by consultants. It's been brought up by our organization. It was brought up by the commission about how much Pittsburgh spends, not compared to, like, the Mount Lebanons and the Upper St. Clairs, but compared to, like, other urban districts in the Commonwealth, Philadelphia, Allentown, Reading. What the Pennsylvania Department of Education does, I mean, one of the things that they show when you look at the expenses is actual instruction cost. That means take away the debt, take away any of the other factors that do not deal with what happens in the classroom. Right, the instructional cost. In Pittsburgh, I mean, again, as Dr. Lane mentioned, near the top in the state, near the top in the county as well, in terms of what they spend per pupil on instruction.
If I might add that, we should not assume that because it's a big number in Pittsburgh that it's overspending.
That's right.
When the costing out study was done, and it is several years old now, the methodology was prescribed by the legislature. It concluded Pittsburgh had enough resources. That begs the question about how they're being spent. But they said Pittsburgh has enough resources. They didn't suggest a cut. They said they have enough. And I would not want to compare them to Reading, for instance. It was just cited because Reading was concluded to be the worst district. The costing out study said that the Reading School District had $5,000 per student per year too little in terms of resources to give all of those kids in the Reading District a chance to accomplish the state's standards and proficiency expectations.
The costing out study was several years ago, and our district has had pretty substantial revenue reductions since then. So we were in a better space then than we are now after losing the charter school reimbursement and no additional money in the basic educational funding formula.
We're discussing how to make funding for public education more equitable so that all children have a chance at a quality education. Our panelists for this community forum are Jay Costa, Linda Lane, Ron Cowell, Eric Montardi, and Linda Kraushore. And once again, we're going to turn to the audience and see if anybody has any questions at this time.
I'm Evelyn Murr, and I'm a retired school psychologist. I'm concerned about special ed, homeless, and how the funding for those children in charters. As a psychologist, occasionally we would be threatened with capping the number of children in a school district who could be identified and served. Could you just speak to that in terms of what the state is contributing?
Well, the governor proposed, I believe, $100 million increase in special education funding. That has fallen on deaf ears up to this point. My expectation is that in this upcoming budget agreement that should be concluded soon, I hope, he'll be putting $50 million in this year and purportedly $50 million next year. And we did put together a special education funding commission to take in various factors and sort of tiering the allocations that the state provides. So we've got a long way to go, but you know, it's a question of limited resources that we were dealing with over the course of the past couple of years. And as we go forward, how we fix spending levels with respect to education and work through each of those areas. It's going to take us a while to have the appropriate level of special education funding along those lines, but we're working towards that end.
In an interview with WESA, Duquesne School of Education Dean Olga Welsh says, educating all of our children is a social justice imperative that the entire community shares. If the commission's recommendations are enacted, would the new formula move the needle when it comes to this social justice argument? I'll start with you, Ron.
Well, it helps. But again, it depends on the degree to which you actually fund the formula or use the formula to distribute dollars in a way that you begin to recognize this this issue of social justice or adequacy or equity or however you want to characterize it. At the end of the line or end of the day, bottom line, it's a question of making sure that the resources are available to support education opportunity for every kid, regardless of what their particular needs are, whether they're complicated or pretty straightforward, regardless of the zip code or the relative wealth of the district where they live.
Linda Lane, you look like you might have a thought.
I spent recent weeks, days, working with the Wilkinsburg School Board, the Wilkinsburg kids, and their teachers. And even though, as I said, Pittsburgh is, you know, is my job. The kids in Pittsburgh are my job. But now, because of the decision of our two boards, the children in Wilkinsburg are our jobs as well. And as I got to talk to the students, it was so difficult for me to hear the things they did not have. Because I know our kids in Pittsburgh, there are lots more things we'd love to have for them too. But when I heard about the kind of lack in the school where children were attending, it was heartbreaking. And I'm sitting here thinking we're in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, but we have children in a school district whose needs aren't even being close to met in their school. And the only ones that seemed to really be upset about that were Wilkinsburg. Where were the rest of us? You know, that's my question. And so as we sit as adults and talk about formulas and Act One and all of those kinds of things, I think let's not forget we have children in this Commonwealth who are not being well served in their school districts. And at the end of the day, that is the issue.
Linda Kraushore?
I think there's something, though, that does get to that issue, and that is the capacity of community. We often think of our schools as existing as an isolated problem or an isolated institution. And building the capacity of community is really what gets at good governance. When people understand what their goals really are, who they're serving, what they're doing. And I think we get lost along the way sometimes, and we have. The consortium worked extremely closely with Duquesne when their high school was closed. And Duquesne was as sad about seeing their high school lost in their community as Wilkinsburg is in its community. But what was so interesting is while the parents and grandparents wanted those high schools to stay open, the kids knew that they were not getting what they would need to become productive, earning adults. They knew that. And it was so hard for them to stand up against their own parents, their own families, their mayors, their communities. But they knew that what would be happening to them would be better. And again, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but I think we have to really think about what not only are our schools doing for our kids, but what their role is in our economy and in our community, and think of them in a very different way if we want to stay, as you said, the leading nation in this world. We are not going to do it by the way we fragment our problems and don't think about them on behalf of the larger goals.
You know, on that issue, Linda raised the West Mifflin situation, and we worked very closely with her and a few others. And I can report to you that I think it's been a success. I've been in a school countless times in West Mifflin where I had the experience the kids from Duquesne being integrated into that school, and it's been a success. Mm-hmm. And my hope is, working now with Dr. Lane and the school boards from Wilkinsburg and the city, our expectations are that we'll replicate what I think took place in West Mifflin, because in my view it's been something that's been very beneficial for those students. And Linda and others did a great job to making sure that happened for the kids, and I think the kids are benefiting from that.
This is our last question, but it's actually a two-part question. So whatever amount we spend, what can be done in terms of equitable funding to ensure that regardless of the school district, all students have access to quality education? And part B to that is, what questions or what areas about this funding formula do you think people are missing? What's something, if you have it, that you want to highlight? And I'm just going to go down the line and start with you and Eric.
I would stress the earlier part about, you know, going and looking and see what the commission did. Look at their recommendations from the final report. We're probably going to see what happens, because if they're supposed to reconvene every 5 years to look at the formula and determine is it a good formula or not, then, you know, if there's going to be some changes to it. I think that... looking at the resources that the state puts out, that the local governments put out, or the school districts, and then, you know, the basic commission's charge was to say, how do we just drive out the money that the state raises? I mean, that was their charge. It wasn't really anything else. So I think all that other, where that, you know, builds in terms of access and, you know, equitable funding and everything, that's just a larger part that probably goes beyond the funding commission itself.
Jay Costa?
Well, I mean, I think it goes to the point that Ron has talked about. I mean, we can have the best funding formula in the world, but if we don't have adequate resources to support it, it doesn't help the effort in the end. And I also think things that we're not maybe paying close enough attention to is the disparity issue, how poorly we are with respect to the disparity. We were making some advancements in the Rendell years when we were making those investments in education. Our kids were doing well. Our scores reflected that. We closed the disparity gap. But now I think we've gotten away from that, largely due to what took place in 2011, where the disparity gap grew. So I think we have to take a look and focus more along those lines as well.
Ron?
Money alone doesn't solve the problem, but you can't solve the problem without sufficient money. So the state has an obligation to provide its fair share to help level the playing field, so that the zip code or the wealth of the district is not the determinant of whether a kid has access to a quality education. But local school boards are very important in this state, and the role of citizens, and I'm looking to this audience here, is very important in this state, because you can have a lot of money and not spend it appropriately, not spend it wisely, not spend it in a way that you do enhance student access to the quality program. And what's missing? What is missing is the certainty that there will be sufficient state appropriations to make that formula meaningful.
Okay. And with all that money, which I totally agree is necessary, I would just add that it is not about testing every kid to death to look at his academic performance. Academic performance, basic skills are critical, but so are the skills required in this current day and age of communication, of problem solving, of creativity, that need to be part of how kids learn basic skills. And lastly, every kid that we graduate that doesn't believe that the future has a place for him or her is a person that is going to be needing other money from our legislature in many, many ways, whether it is to keep them in jail, to keep them in some kind of support. So we need to recognize that if we evaluate totally the wrong way this good spending of more money, we are not going to get what we want.
Linda Lane? Mm-hmm.
I agree with Senator Costa in that a formula is important. It is. But unless there's cash behind it, you know, it's just philosophical, basically. So that's going to be extremely important, that there is money to actually make it work, because I think we've all heard there's a formula before, but the money wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And to get back to that place is not a success. To the question on the quality education and access, addressing needs of the whole child, whether that is some of the issues some of you raised, homelessness, neighborhoods that are difficult. Some of our children are raising their younger brothers and sisters. Why can't you get to school? You're late. And we ask them, and they say, well, I have to get my brother on the bus before I can come to school. And so, you know, we should be glad they're there. So those kinds of things are things we're going to have to address above and beyond the academic piece. The academic piece is very, very important. We understand that. We also know that that's not the whole thing. That is not the whole thing. And for many of our children, until we can address some of those things that are around them, it makes it very hard for them to engage in their academic learning. So we have to be able to provide the foundational support they're going to need so that when they go into that classroom, they can attend to what the teacher is saying. They can take their things home so they're going to do their homework if they have it. And those are the things that I think are going to be very important, especially for a district like ours.
That concludes this 90.5 WESA Life of Learning Community Forum. Special thanks to our panelists, State Senator Jay Costa, Ron Cowell, President of the Education Policy and Leadership Center, Linda Kraushor, Executive Director, Consortium for Public Education, Linda Lane, Superintendent, Pittsburgh Public Schools, and Eric Montardi, Senior Policy Analyst, Allegheny Institute of Public Policy. The assistant producer for this forum, Sarah Schneider. Production assistants, Maura McLaughlin and Sean Ray. Marketing, Elizabeth Baisley. Director of Engineering, Russ Lloyd. Executive producer for special news projects, Kevin Gavin. Thanks to our audience here at the Community Broadcast Center, I'm Larkin Page Jacobs. This has been a special news presentation from 90.5 WESA. Thank you.